So where to start this week? It's been a kind of 10 pounds of rice day or week or month a little bit. I don't know if you recall a comment I was given that so often it feels I may be trying to fit 10 pounds of rice into a 5-pound bag with these sermons, but I have yet to find a 10-pound bag, so I'll keep looking. But this is an important topic today, thinking about how we are seen or how we see others, how we might feel excluded or exclude others from the sanctuary of our relationships by not being seen or not seeing. There is a lot to this. I want to start this morning by mentioning a very thoughtful letter I received recently from a member of this congregation asking about a suggestion I made in the e-news recently. I announced that the idea of gathering in the e-news several weeks back, actually, I suggested we try a vegetarian night. The idea for the gathering followed closely on the heels of a sermon I gave several weeks ago at the Animal Blessing Sunday, where I said, I'm asking us to represent an aspiration of care as a faith community that does not judge our individual choices, but offers an alternative way of being. And I should have added the words in community, that is, an alternative way of being in community relative to what foods we bring to share with each other. I want to reiterate that the middle of that sentence about not judging our individual choices. And as I mentioned in my response to the letter I received, our dietary wants and needs are highly individual, and we must all respect that and respect each other's choices. And I am hoping there is room for a conversation about the way our choices are made more difficult by two things. First, the agri-industry that manipulates all our choices about everything we eat, plant-based, animal, fowl, fish. And second, the climate change that is impacted by our food sources and their production. Those two things have changed the realities of the equation of how we make our dietary choices. And I'm just hoping that we can be in conversation about it. And I wanted it to feel like an invitation, not a judgment. And I'm really grateful that someone took the time to help me see the discomfort that my brevity had created. I apologize for not seeing that. It feels to me representative of how we often do not see each other. In chapter 7 of the book of Matthew, which some of you may be familiar with, the prophet Jesus says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there is a plank in your own? You hypocrite, for first take the plank out of your eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brothers." And my friends, it was not my intent to point out the stick in the eyes of any of my brothers or sisters, but only to raise up an issue that we are all confronted with. And then while I am very aware of the speck in my own eyes, or the multiple specks in my own eyes, particularly around the issues of choices, I did not consider that it might have felt to someone else that I was pointing to something in theirs. I was not paying attention to that possibility, so I didn't see it. I am so sorry for that. I figure out, though, it is fortuitous of me to have unwittingly provided such a handy example of the ways like this and so many others, no doubt, that it feels we stop seeing each other, or that we experience not being seen, because it's not the obvious differences that often jump up. We see things like age and color. We see size and shape. We see sometimes differences in physical abilities. We see different paces in our movement. We don't always respond well to these differences either, but not because we don't see them. There are huge numbers of other distinctions that are invisible to us, different ways of communicating, for one thing, different ways of receiving the world, like the way that something like ADHD affects our self-perceptions, as we heard in Oifi's story. We don't see the pain of self-judgment that we likely all share to varying degrees. We often don't see in others the periods, sometimes long periods, of suffering sadness. We often don't see shyness exactly, or the struggle of introverts among us. We don't see illnesses that aren't obvious to others around us, like cancer or bipolar disorder or post-traumatic stress syndrome or impacts of trauma. We could see them, we could learn to see them if we were more discerning, perhaps. What I notice is that our contemporary culture disinclines us to that depth of contact. I was reading recently the book Tribe by Sebastian Younger. It may be familiar to some of you. He says, a person living in a modern city or a suburb can, for the first time in history, go through an entire day or an entire life, mostly encountering complete strangers. I am aware I can go through entire days mostly encountering no one if I want to, when I work from home, on my computer. Sometimes the only person I see is the mail carrier, who I would miss but for the dog who barks at him. He goes quickly, our mail carrier, so as not to spend too much time with this angry dog. The hazards of these habits are profound. They're isolating, and they're antithetical to the kind of community building and intimacy and belonging that is so important to our emotional health. It is easy to get out of the practice of developing meaningful relationships, of reaching out to others and saying, "How are you? Really, how are you? What is making you happy today? What is weighing on your heart?" I watched an amazing story the other day on my computer about a child, maybe about 10 years old, who couldn't keep his body still, or his hands at least. He kept tapping, tapping, tapping everywhere he went. And it was distracting and annoying to those around him. He kept getting told, "Stop that," or given ways to fix his tapping. "Sit on your hands during the entire class or leave. Hold your hands together." Until one teacher called him in after school and mentioned that he had noticed his tapping and handed him a pair of drumsticks. "You're not a problem," he said. "You're a drummer." And the boy's life was changed. He is to this day a drummer, a successful middle-aged adult. It is easy to get out of the habit of seeing each other and the alternative perspectives to what otherwise appear to be problems, even though the door to opportunities for a different perception are as available as our rush to judgment. This has long been a human foible, I'm sure, only exacerbated by our physical isolation from each other, our inability to actually see each other in many possibilities. But I'm also thinking that at least it is at least as big a concern, if not an even greater one, in the way that we are isolating ourselves across our communities, not just within our individual lives. If I think for a while about our Unitarian Universalist inclination, we pride ourselves on our sense of radical welcome, right? In the spirit of love, all are welcome here. And by and large, truly, we mean that. And I imagine we try to emulate that welcome in our personal lives. We intend to understand and welcome the other, unless this won't shock us, unless their political perspective is different from our own. And this is especially tough for us right now, right? For years, our indicator of kindred spirit was the Prius. Or the bumper sticker that says coexist, you. You know, the one with all the different religious symbols on it? I'm not 100% sure, but 98. I was speaking with our sanctuary guest this week, the guest whose life we help support and in the sanctuary at the Beth El Yemi Church in Jamaica Plain. We were talking about our capacities across language barriers, how we're able to discern what is being shared among people. When I don't understand, he said, and by this he meant literally not understanding the language, when I don't understand, I feel very sad. And I wonder if we feel that way about those who think differently than we do, who have different ideological or political persuasions than ours. Does it make us sad? Angry comes to mind more easily. Righteous also jumps up, though maybe not as often as it should. But I'm not sure how often we feel sad about it. You may have seen an article recently, as I did, in The Atlantic, about our politically correct culture. Did anybody happen to stumble on that? I'll put a link to it. Author Yasha Monk, who is a lecturer on government at Harvard University, references a report by a group called More in Common. And their report suggests that there are 7 identifiable groups in our political landscape. So I want you to think about this for a minute. 7 groups. Progressive activists. It's no accident I'm using my left hand. Traditional liberals, passive liberals, the politically disengaged, moderates, traditional conservatives, and devoted conservatives. So among those 7, have you found yourself? Progressive activist, traditional liberal, passive liberal, politically disengaged, traditional, moderates, traditional conservatives, and devoted conservatives. According to the report, 25% of Americans are traditional or devoted conservatives, and their views are far outside the American mainstream. So let's imagine 25 people out of 100. If there are roughly 100 of us here together, a quarter of the church is going to be traditional or devoted conservatives. We'll let that represent all of you back there. Remember, their views are far outside the American mainstream. Some 8% of Americans are progressive activists, and their views are even less typical. So there are 8 of you, just sort of right here, that's it, out of the 100. That whole quarter, conservatives, 8 of you are progressive activists. By contrast, the 2/3 of Americans who don't belong to either constitute an exhausted majority. So all the rest of you are the exhausted majority, the roughly 67%. Their members share a sense of fatigue with our polarized national conversation. They share a willingness to be flexible in their political viewpoints, and they share a lack of voice in the national conversation. Just out of curiosity, what group do we think Unitarian Universalists identify most with? And I don't want us to make too many assumptions here. But an FYI, the progressive activists are, quote, politically engaged, highly educated, left-leaning Americans, the kinds of people, in other words, who are in charge of universities, edit the nation's most important newspapers and magazines, and advise Democratic political candidates on their campaigns. So my guess is that most of us identify, at least in this New England environment of Unitarian Universalists, on the left-leaning spectrum. Exceptionally well-meaning, willing to work hard for the values that we hold very dear to our hearts. But what the vast majority of Americans seem to see, apparently, according to this report, is not so much our genuine concern for social justice as, quote, the preening display of cultural superiority. Ouch. And I wondered, is that what my invitation to the vegetarian dinner sounded like? For the millions upon millions of Americans, this is also from our report, of all ages and all races who do not follow politics with rapt attention and who are much more worried about paying their rent than about debating the prom dress worn by a teenager in Utah, contemporary call-out culture merely looks like an excuse to mock the values or ignorance of others. As one 57-year-old woman in Mississippi fretted, the way you have to term everything just right, and this is the idea of our political correctness, and if you don't term it right, you discriminate them. It's like everybody's going to be in the know of what people call themselves now, and some of us just don't know. But if you don't know, then there's something seriously wrong with you. The report continues, in a democracy, it is difficult to win fellow citizens over to your own side or to build public support to remedy injustices that remain all too real when you fundamentally misunderstand how they see the world. I fear in our extremes, we have become caricatures to each other, that side of the room and this small gathering. So we're in a pickle, aren't we? We're really honestly trying to make things better in an increasingly polarized environment where we are ever more isolated from each other, and even as we are trying so hard to do well by each other, by every other. At the end of the day, and one more time today, I have to laugh at myself. I asked my son last spring if he had noticed the second base person making a call on out, or maybe, you know, sending a ball or knocking somebody out on third. And he said, "Did you really just say second base person?" Like, it's American League baseball, Mom. I'm pretty sure there are no women on the field or wherever they play. It's not a feat. So I have drunk the Kool-Aid, just like many of us, and someone from the exhausted majority is shaking their head at me. Seriously? Second base person. It doesn't mean I'm going to back off my efforts to do justice, but I did have to laugh at myself. I wonder, do you ever feel invisible? What is it you want people to see about you? I'm thinking we might start there, a kind of think global, act local. Start with each other, with as much open curiosity and humility as we can muster, to reach out across our atomized environments and find some common ground, to make as few assumptions as possible, to offer the shelter of our bodies during the storm, to not exclude those who may think differently than we do, and to believe that we can see each other. Mary Oliver reminds us, belief isn't always easy, but this much I have learned, if not enough else, to live with my eyes open. It is, of course, the only way to see. So let's start again, just there, eyes open, willing to try when someone says, "Do you see me?" May it be so.